This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 11 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have World Cup champion, Olympic gold medalist, and Fox Sports broadcaster Heather O'Reilly joining us to discuss the 2023 Women's World Cup, which is taking place in Australia and New Zealand. And Heather, obviously we're recording this before you leave for Australia, but I imagine you've probably been there at some point during your playing career. Are you ready for that time difference?
I have been to Sydney before. I'm gearing up for the flight. I'm actually bringing my little infant, my 1.5-year-old over.
Oh, wow.
So gearing up mentally, not only for the World Cup, but for that flight over, for the time change. It's not across town. And so it will present some challenges, I think. But nothing that I'm not ready for, that the U.S. team isn't ready for. I know that they just touched down in New Zealand. I saw some photos and stuff like that. So they are they're safely over there and on the boots on the ground, as they say.
Yeah, I've made the trip myself. It was about 30 hours door to door for me from the time I left my house on Long Island to the time where we arrived at our hotel on the South Island of New Zealand. And I don't remember the time difference being much of an issue while we were there, but it definitely took a couple of days to get reacclimated when I got home. That being said, I can't imagine doing it with a 1.5-year-old. That's an entirely different challenge. But how long are you going to have to acclimate from the time that you arrive until the time that you start working?
We'll have about 4 days. I'm going down there with Fox Sports, and Fox has covered the Women's World Cup now for 2015 and 2019, which I was part of both of those. One on the pitch in 2015,
right,
with the U.S. Women's National Team winning gold there, and then in 2019 I kind of changed roles and I was part of the Fox analyst team there in Paris. And now we'll be heading down to Australia. So we're going to be there for about 4 days before we're kicking off the tournament. And we're super excited. I mean, Australia and New Zealand have been prepping for this for a long time. I know a lot of people down there, especially Australians, that have been working on this for years. 80,000 people expected for the Australia-Ireland game that will be in Sydney. So, you know, there's some really huge crowds expected. So every World Cup we say, you know, this one's the best one yet. And we're saying the same thing here for New Zealand, Australia. I think it'll have the best crowds. Women's football across the globe is getting just, the quality is getting better and better. That makes US's job a little bit harder. But I think it will be an incredible event. The only downside is the time change.
Yeah.
For American fans. But if we can kind of get past that, and there's been many World Cups where people have gotten up early or gone to bed late, and I think this one will be no different. This team has a lot to offer, and I think the fans will get behind them.
How was that that transition of being at a World Cup as a broadcaster? Is it nerve-wracking watching the World Cup and not being able to be on the field? Like, I'm sure you're still very emotionally invested in the U.S. national team, but now you can't help the outcome.
Right. Yeah, no, it was a very emotional transition, I think. You know, I had a long and very successful career on the national team in club football, but it's still sad when the time comes that it's probably best to hang up the boots. You know, I was in my mid-30s. I had, you know, other dreams and ambitions to have kids, and I had done it. Like, I had really done it, you know, 230 caps for the U.S. team. And so it was time to, you know, pass the torch, I guess, to the next generation of players. But that's hard for any athlete. And so I think from an emotional standpoint of watching the team win, but not being part of it and being behind the microphone, I would be lying if I didn't say that that was a difficult transition. Thrilled to be still part of the game and part, you know, if you can't do it on the pitch anymore, I always joke, might as well be the person that's saying what they should be doing. So yeah, I think that was difficult, and I didn't get as nervy, I don't think, as like being a player. Like, granted, I can't affect the outcome, but you know, when you're a player, I mean, there's so much that goes into those tournaments. You have your friends and family there. You're trying to get the perfect amount of rest and watch what you're eating and make sure you're hydrating. And it's like, am I starting? Am I not starting? Am I, you know, training well? There's just so much. And I mean, as a broadcaster, it's hard. It's challenging. You want to bring your A game, but yeah, it's a little bit more relaxed than when you're a professional. And the U.S. national team like has a win or bust mentality, right? For the World Cup. It's like, if they win, it's sort of expected. If they lose, it's a bit of a failure. So super high stakes, high standard for the women's national team.
And like, do you try to be an unbiased broadcaster when you're calling the World Cup? Is Fox okay with you like kind of bringing some of your competitiveness on air? Like, I think as someone who would be watching, I think the audience probably prefers to hear that fandom bleed through at times. It makes the broadcast more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I try to be authentic. Obviously, you know, you go into a new profession thinking, you know, or not knowing, I guess, what your voice will be or what spin you're going to put on the information that you put out. And at the end of the day, I can only be myself. I can only be authentic. I am a bullish person on the women's national team. I mean, the women's national team has been part of my life since I was a teenager. You know, I first made the national team at 17 years old. So I've spent, you know, so many of my formative years through the U.S. program. So I am like, this is a big part of my life, right? And so I can't ignore that. I can't take that away. And I think that's that love of the program and of international soccer and, you know, doing it for so many years, I think that gives me some, you know, really interesting like ability to analyze the team. That being said, I think as a player, like the women's game has evolved. We don't want just cheerleaders now. If a play is terrible, you know, you need to be able to say it's terrible, or like, you know, people are looking to be informed and educated on, you know, high level situations in the game. And so I think that I try to bring that. If I'm going to make a, like an absurd statement, I better back it up with what I see on the pitch. So I think I'm trying to be fair, back it up with data and be authentic and high energy. I'm a high energy person. I hope that I can bring that. And you know, a nice balance with my colleagues. I work with Alexi Lawless, Carly Lloyd, who, yeah, I mean, they definitely have opinions and are not afraid to share them. I think it makes great television. I think in general, my personality is one that will be thoughtful, balanced, leaning on the positive side, but fair.
You retired from the U.S. national team in 2016 and club soccer in 2019. And now you've obviously since unretired. but in 2019... when you retired, did you think that was going to be it for you in terms of competitive soccer?
Yes. Thanks for saying that. So what you're referring to is I call it my faux comeback. I had a little bit of a comeback last year because in 2019, I hung on my boots. I felt like I'd done it. There was a few things in European football that I had never done. I went and played over at Arsenal for a year and a half, but when we were there, we didn't make Champions League. And I knew that going over there that we weren't in the Champions League. At that point in international soccer on the women's side, only two from England made Champions League. And so we got third the year before I got there. I was like, okay, no big deal. I've won World Cups. I've won gold medals. It's fine that I've never played Champions League. I can get over it. And then when my time was sort of done there, we got third again. And so it was always sort of this thing that nagged me. And I think, you know, anybody that's played high level athletics, like you have, like something is wrong with us in our brain. Like we are just so competitive and yeah, I had two kids. I got on with my life, but like this Champions League thing just kept sitting with me. It just pissed me off, quite frankly, that I never played Champions League. And so after I had my babies, I wanted to have two kids. So I, you know, back to back, let's go. didn't waste a minute. And then I'm like, I'm pretty fit still. Like, I'm 37 last summer. I was like, you know, running. I ran the Boston Marathon. And then I, you know, it got into my head, like, if you're going to play Champions League, this is the year to play Champions League. So I went back and played with a team called Shelburne out of Dublin. And I made my Champions League debut, scored a goal at age 37. Then we got knocked out in the next round, which was like fairly expected, but had a blast and checked that box. So yeah, I did kind of make a faux comeback, and now I still play like just like amateur. I'm on this under 23 team because yeah, I just love the game. So I've requested them to rename it the U39s. So they're thinking about that. So yeah, I guess to answer your question, I think I'm one of those people that will always have the game of soccer in my life, whether it's in announcing, whether it's in coaching, or whether it's in playing. Maybe it's playing with my kids. Maybe it's playing pickup. You know, I live in a college town at University of North Carolina, so there's always like some 20-year-olds playing soccer. And I really hope that my heart and my head and my body stays to a point that I can always play this game. And that's the hope.
Did or does announcing help to fill the void of not playing anymore?
It does. It really does. And in 2019, like I said, it was difficult from an emotional standpoint to not be on that side of things anymore. But I vividly remember after they won, and I still had, you know, some very good mates on the team. Kelly O'Hara is one of my best buddies, Megan Rapinoe, and Allie Krieger. And so I FaceTimed them when they got on, you know, the bus. And of course there's like champagne everywhere. The trophy's there. Everybody's like screaming like, Heather. And I'm like, you know, super pumped for them. And because the final was in Lyon, somebody that I was with was just like, oh man, like bummer that you're not in Lyon, because we were Paris based. Bummer you're not in Lyon. You could party with the girls. And being the last night of the tournament, I was like, no, I don't want to be with anybody else except my broadcast team right now. Like, this is my team. And so I think from a camaraderie standpoint, that has been great. Like, you know, you have a new team that you work with, and your relationships, and you're, you know, you all are bringing a different strength, and you're trying to, you know, bring the best out of each other and learn about each other and how you can fill in each other's, you know, weaker spots with your strengths, et cetera. So there is some, you know, parallels between sports and working together in the broadcast field. And I also think like when that live button comes on and it's game time, you know, it's a similar adrenaline to big games.
Yeah.
And so I do feel like being on, especially live television, definitely replicates like the performance of athletics. And so it really has had many more parallels than I think that I expected.
Does now still playing, does that help your analysis or work as a broadcaster at all? Or even on the contrary, does being an analyst help you as a player and coach? Is there any correlation between the two in that sense?
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, I think all three of the things are connected. And I was laughing, as I said, I was playing on this U23 team. I'm like a player coach. So sometimes I'm like drawing up the session. Sometimes I'm in the session. And sometimes I've done television, not about the under 23s, but about the Courage. And so my friend was joking. He's like, soon you're going to be doing the, you know, have the headset on and then just rip the headset off and say, I can do it better and get on the field. So we might still do that because I think that that would just make like a great Instagram reel or something. But I think that playing, you know, being an analyst and coaching is all like really related to each other. And it's important that I think that you remember those different perspectives, because like now as an analyst, I know even, you know, what the players are thinking, you know, what's going on the field, what's going on off the field, how much things going on off the field are important. Like in 2019, for instance, the US team played all their players in the first two games. They had the luxury of essentially, I don't want to have to say like weaker opponents, but they were able to play all let's call it, I don't want to get the stat wrong, but essentially all the field players, they were able to play. And I kept talking about that. And I was like, this is really huge. Like every field player is playing. And a lot of people were like, okay, like what's the big deal? Like these are deep subs, like reserve players. Is it like that big of a deal? And I'm like, for team morale and, you know, you're together in the hotel for like a month at a time. You have your friends and family that are coming. Like something like everybody being able to lace them up and get into the World Cup is so big for all the players and the whole team. And I know that as a player, like in 2015, like I can still remember every single player played except for one. And we could probably all like name who that player was. And I think it like deeply affected that player. So I guess what I'm saying is I still remember the things that were important for a team, like little nuances that maybe wouldn't be super obvious to somebody from the outside. I feel like I'm still in it enough. And I never want to lose that because I think it gives me really good insights to being a good coach and a good analyst.
Was there ever a point since retiring from the U.S. national team in 2016 that you thought about making a comeback to play in another World Cup?
Listen, I have like all the self-belief in the world. Like I am a very confident person. I always joke that it's all started for me. I can vividly remember being a kid and I was in this like hotel gym with my brother at his soccer tournament. And I was down with my other brother just messing. I was probably way far too young to be down in this weight room. And my brother just being silly, just amps up the treadmill to like the highest speed. And I'm just like this little like competitive little tomboy. And I'm like, I can run on that. I'm fast. And like, he's like, no. He like basically like stiff arms me. He's like, no, don't run on that. Like that's way too fast for you. And I'm just seeing it whip around. And I'm like, no, I can do it. And of course I step on the treadmill and like, I'm like a 4-year-old. So I just get flung back immediately to like the back wall. And like this thing's whipping around. It's like, you know, cutting my leg basically. And I'm just like, so humbled by the fact that like I could not keep up with that treadmill. And so I think to answer your question, my self-belief would love to say that I could still play at the very tip-top level of the World Cup, but I think that ship has sailed. And like I said, like I was an early bloomer in my career. Like I made the national team at 17, you know, 230 caps between age 17 and age 31. And so, you know, when I think about the years that I probably peaked, it's probably my late 20s. And so now I'm in my late 30s. And so, yes, my brain and my heart likes to say like, yeah, you can still do it. You can still score goals and assist at the highest level. But, yeah, I think that, I'll leave it up to the young guns now and formulate my new craft and my new project, which is being an analyst. And yeah, thrilled to work with Fox again. I mean, I had a great experience in 2019 and yeah, excited to run it back this year. And we're going for what's never been done before with the women's national team. And that's 3 World Cup wins in a row consecutive. I call it the hat trick of World Cup wins. It has never been done. Not even the Brazilian men's team has won 3 in a row. So the U.S. has, a big challenge ahead of them. And I know that we as Fox would love to be able to be the first ever as well.
How was the response to winning that the World Cup in 2015? You were on the first women's team to get a ticker tape parade in New York City. You also visited the White House after that win. Was there a favorite or most memorable moment from those celebrations?
Yeah, well, I think you're onto something with besides, you know, my wedding day and the birth of my 2 kids, which, you know, gotta say is the best day of your life, right? The next best day, wink, wink, would definitely be the day that I had a ticker tape parade in New York City. And I grew up in Jersey, by the way. So I was like, my family was like on the float and I had some high school buddies that like saw me. So it was very special. But we did the float in the morning. In the afternoon, Barack Obama called us and we're just like yucking it up with him. You know, not just myself, but like the whole team and we're on speakerphone, like, Barry, what's up? Thanks for the call. And then in the evening, I went on stage at the Taylor Swift concert at MetLife. And it was so epic. It was like the craziest, most awesome day ever. And Taylor was like, you know, first name basis there. She was so lovely and she was so excited to see us. And I remember she asked if we could come, you know, early to MetLife so we can do rehearsal. And so we're walking towards her. She's walking towards us. It was like a big love fest. She was so excited that we were there. And it was so cute because we're like, all right, what do we do? Like, we're like not very good dancers. Like, are you sure you want us dancing on stage and singing and stuff? And she was like, heck yeah. Anyway, so we all had our jerseys on. And she brings us in before the concert and we're all huddled up in her like backstage dressing room. And she just like knows that we're like totally jocks, right? So she gets out her like nail polish bag. She's got all these nail polishes and she like lines them up like it's a formation, like in a tactics board. And she's like, okay, so then I'm going to come out at this verse. And then she's like moving the nail polish along. She's like, and here's Abby's spot. And here's where Heather's going to go. And it was so funny because like we're back there and like Abby's in there and like she's getting so into it. She's like, yeah, yeah. And it was like totally a sign from a movie. But yeah, Taylor knew how to speak the sports speak to us. So we actually knew what we were doing. But that day was pretty cool. And truthfully, I mean, I've won 3 Olympic gold medals. But for a soccer player, this was like the elusive prize in my career. We had gotten bronze in 2007. We were so close, lost in penalty kick shootout in 2011. Really should have probably won that World Cup, but we just couldn't get it over the line. And then able to do it in 2015, which for Abby Wambach, Shannon Box, myself, like players of that sort of generation, really was sort of like the closing chapter and this thing that we had waited and tried to do for a long time. And we finally did it.
What did Grant Wall mean to soccer in the U.S. and specifically women's soccer, recognizing its potential and covering the sport at a time when it was overlooked by a lot of journalists and media outlets?
Wow. Well, thanks for asking about Grant. I mean, I think about him often. I wouldn't say we were, you know, best friends or anything, but we were friends, especially as I moved over to the, you know, the broadcast side. And he was always so gracious with his time. And, you know, we worked together briefly at Fox and were with each other in Paris. And yeah, I mean, Grant really was the name of soccer journalism, not just women's soccer, but also men's soccer. I remember his name for the longest time because he wrote a Sports Illustrated article on Mia Hamm, like early days when she was playing. And I remember seeing his name on the front of Sports Illustrated. So he was just always this figure, I think, that represented quality journalism. Like, he knew what he was talking about. He wasn't afraid to ask the hard questions. Everybody knew that, like, not in a bad or like, you know, nefarious way, but just kind of like, okay, you knew that this wasn't going to be a fluff piece. Like, this was going to be something of substance, but he did it in classy ways. And he was just always there. You just always saw him there. And then, you know, I quite frankly was asked to go to Qatar for FIFA. Like, you know, I'm part of Legends programs and do a lot of like promo events for FIFA. Quite frankly, I was hesitant, I think, to go to Qatar considering, you know, a lot of the topics that were surrounding the tournament in terms of human rights issues, of building stadiums. Did I want to go, you know, over there alone as a female, blah, 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 all the things, right? And so I was sitting on this decision. Plus, I have 2 young kids at home, so just schedule-wise was difficult. And I knew that Grant was over there. This was like the beginning of the tournament. So I shot him an email, and this was honestly 3 days before he died. And so we're going back on email. I'm like kind of like, hey, I'm hemming and hawing about going over. Like, how have you found the tournament? And he's just like, well, listen, like, make your own decision however you want to. But like, I've had a really positive experience. Here's what's been good. Here's our some question marks. And he basically encouraged me to go. And then he died. It was wild. And so, of course, I went. And Yeah, he I think meant a lot to the sport, more than I think that we all know, because he was an information passer. And you know, I don't think that you know sometimes, like, okay, yeah, that article really hit home for me. Like, say this Mia article, like, that probably inspired me so deeply as a young person. And that wouldn't have happened if that wasn't Grant Wall being interested in that story as well and committing to his craft to make sure that that story was told. So I think, I mean, you know, after games, he would do these three things I learned about the game, and I still miss them. Like, in the morning after a national team game, I'm like, oh man, where's the three things from Grant, you know? What a professional, really nice guy, really always so generous with his time. And he really did a lot for the sport. So I think that all of us just try to do Grant, you know, some justice, I think, in terms of like asking hard questions, inquiring into stories that maybe are not covered for whatever reason, you know, and just digging a little bit deeper into some topics, is, I think, what he would be proud of.
How was your experience in Qatar?
It was great. It was great. I mean, you know, I'm not naive to not recognize that there's probably a lot going on behind the scenes that, like, I don't see. So I can only talk about from what I experienced. You know, I had a great experience. You know, I think that there is benefits to bringing soccer to different parts of the globe. You know, I do think that it is a uniting force for good. You know, Fox appreciates that. FIFA appreciates that. You know, it probably introduced the game to a lot of young people, females in the Middle East that wouldn't be exposed to it otherwise. So I think that there are some positives, but that's not to say that it was all positive. I think that, like, our brains can work in a way that that allow us to hold both things at the same time, that, like, you know, maybe certain topics weren't addressed properly or should still be investigated, and it served some positive things. So at the end of the day, I had a great, you know, couple of days. I was not there for very long, and I was already actually back in the US before Messi won and Argentina won. So, I mean, what a story, right? I mean, Messi deserves it as probably the best of all time. And it always hasn't been smooth sailing for Argentina and for him. There's a lot of parallels that are going on in the Women's World Cup right now. You have Megan Rapinoe basically saying that she's going to be retiring after this tournament or after the season. You have Marta saying this is her last World Cup. So I think those two players in particular are hoping that they're going out the same way that Messi did. And I know that both squads are probably putting a little bit of extra pressure on themselves. Like, let's make sure that this legend goes out with a win, like Messi did. So it will be interesting. That's for sure.
What do you think about Megan Rapinoe recently announcing that she's going to retire? Will you talk to her about the transition to a post-playing career?
Yeah, I've actually already been texting with her. Just, you know, obviously I just wanted to wish her well. I'm sure she's getting bombarded with messages, not only on the retirement, but then good luck in the World Cup kind of thing. So I just tried to keep it short and let her know that that I was, you know, really honored to be her teammate. And she's actually my good friend too. You know, we played together nearly 10 years, you know, on the national team. And, you know, through that too, you go through ebbs and flows of your normal life as well, that you're like there for each other. So it's not just the on the field stuff, certainly. I think it's very fitting for Megan to like announce it at this time. It was at a press conference. It was, you know, well-timed. I think it allows her to really kind of like get this monkey off her back and to just release herself to like being like, yes, this is my last. It's like almost like her pose at the 2019 World Cup that people probably have ingrained in their memory is like her with her arms out and just kind of like, this is me, world, like take it in. And I feel like her announcing it before the World Cup is another one of those like liberating moments for her to just say out loud, like, this is it for me. This is the final run. Like, let's go. And in that way, I think that it's great. It allows people over the next couple of months to really celebrate her, which she deserves. And it gives her team, like I said, a chance to like really send her out in style. She's 38. So I think that like she's had a hell of a career. If you would have told me like in our early 20s that, you know, Megan would be playing until she was 38, I'd say like you're absolutely crazy, because, you know, she liked the performance. She liked big games, but she didn't necessarily like train super hard. She didn't like take care of herself. And quite frankly, when she started dating Sue Bird, who was also like late in her career, Sue had a wonderful, I think, impact on Megan. And then all of a sudden, Megan is playing some of her best football in her 30s. I think it all kind of came together in the 2019 World Cup. And she's winning Ballon d'Or, then she's winning Golden Boot. You know, she's taking massive penalty kicks that the whole world is watching. And so, I'm super impressed with the longevity of her career. Not only is she extremely talented, but she's done it for a long time. And that's not even talking about all the things that she's done off the field, where she's been an activist. She's fought for change, and she's fought for things that like that don't really concern her and her existence on this planet, but she has compassion and empathy, and is thoughtful enough, I think, to fight for people that can't fight for themselves, or she provides a voice for people because she thinks it's the right thing to do. And I think that bravery and boldness and sometimes brashness, but in a good way, are things that I learned from her, and she always inspired me with.
You were retired by the time the equal pay lawsuit was filed, but were you still involved in that fight? And how do you feel about the progress?
Yeah, I was. I actually received my first check just a couple of weeks ago, which is an interesting feeling. Interesting, I think, because I spoke of in the beginning of this program, like I'm a U.S. soccer kid. I mean, U.S. soccer has, ever since, you know, I went to the 94 World Cup, I was 9 years old at Giants Stadium. So that I was like a fan. And then, you know, I went to the 99 World Cup, also at Giants Stadium. And I was like an inspired young woman. And then, you know, I'm part of these World Cups. So basically what I'm saying is like U.S. Soccer Federation is like in my fabric. It's in my DNA. Like it's my family, essentially. And so, you know, I'm suing a family member, or I'm part of a class action lawsuit that's suing a family member. And it was hard for a long time for me to like wrap my head around, again, with holding these conflicting thoughts at the same time, right? Could I be proud to be part of U.S. soccer? Yes. Did they advance women's soccer before a lot of other countries? Yes. Were we getting paid a lot more than other women around the world? Yes. Still, was it fair and equitable? No, it wasn't. And I think that took me a while to reconcile and to realize, yeah, like throughout certain years, especially years that I was part of, when, you know, World Cup wins and Olympic wins, number one in the world, I was deserving more money. And so I think that, you know, we're super proud that we fought for that. I think that it showed a lot of athletes across the world what, you know, fighting for what you deserve looks like. I think, you know, the soccer world will be better for it. You know, the amount of women's national teams that reach out to the U.S. women's national team, even just in soccer and other sports too, but in soccer, it's like, you guys really inspired us. Now we're brave enough to speak up to our federation. And so, yeah, we've been leaders. I think I say we, because I'm proud to be part of this like sisterhood, this movement, but it's people like Megan Rapinoe that were bold enough, and Becky Sauerbrunn that like just didn't back down, and Abby Wambach, and all the players that came before, you know, like So yes, I think to answer your question, I was conflicted by the entire process, but I'm very proud. And if it moved the needle for society, if it moved the needle for women's sports, that's phenomenal. And I think, athletes will be better taken care of going forward because they know now to fight what they deserve.
How does the future of men's and women's soccer look in the U.S. in your opinion? Because the men are sort of playing catch up to other countries in men's soccer, but in women's soccer, other countries are attempting to meet the standard that's now been set by the U.S. Are those arcs going to shift, or are they already shifting?
Yeah, I mean, the women's game is growing exponentially around the world. It's a wonderful thing. Like when I started on the national team in the early 2000s, I mean, even in Germany, which was one of the powerhouses, I mean, these women are like working through the day and then they would like train with Frankfurt in the evening. And they were still one of the best national teams in the world. So you can imagine that like now you pump some resources into these women, into the clubs, you know, you have like Barcelona and Wolfsburg and Lyon and PSG and Arsenal, my former club, and Manchester City, all these clubs that, you know, are paying the women now. They are professional athletes, so they can focus on their craft. They're surrounded by sports scientists and doctors. So there's just more resources to go around. And so, you know, clearly that's going to translate to international play as well. And so where the U.S. had a leg up always because essentially of Title IX from the 70s, which, you know, allowed essentially a huge blanketed training ground for athletes, you know, 19-year-old women, 20-year-old women, 21-year-old women to, you know, essentially go to college and get their, you know, their training paid for. They didn't have to do anything except be a student and train. And so this wasn't happening in other parts of the world. So from the very beginning, from like the 70s, then all of a sudden you had women that were like great athletes. And Anson Dorrance gets a hold of those athletes in 91 and it wins the first Women's World Cup. And as they say, winning breeds winning, right? So you win the first 91 World Cup, then you're kind of known as a leader. You have all these athletes coming through college. And so the pipeline just was like brewing, right? And, you know, they were looking over in Europe, which are soccer countries. America's not yet a soccer nation. You know, soccer sits, I think, the fourth most popular sport. So you have these European countries like looking over so enviously. It's like, one, they have the population to do it. Two, they have just this societal acceptance that girls can be athletes, women can be athletes. And so they were envious, I think. And now, you know, into the 2000s and then present day, now finally these soccer countries are getting women paid. And so those two things are, you know, now elevating the game worldwide. And yes, they are coming for us. You know, I think that the U.S. women's national team will always have a little bit of an edge with just like this crazy competitiveness, never say die attitude. We've seen it with the U.S. national team time and time again. You can't shut off your TV with a few minutes left if the U.S. is losing, even if they're losing like 3-0. You can't shut off your television because there's a chance that they're going to fight back and come back, right? We've seen it so many times. So they still have a bit of an edge, but the rest of the world is certainly catching up, especially like the middle tier. Now you have a team like Portugal, for instance, that we're playing third in the group. You know, 10 years ago, you'd be like, oh gosh, that's a 5-0 result. Now I'm kind of like, I'm a little worried about Portugal because Benfica is a pretty good Champions League club team. And these women play with each other all the time. All of a sudden, I'm worried about Portugal. And you have, you know, your Sweden, your Germany, your Spain, your France, England, that could like potentially win the thing. So certainly on the women's side, they are catching up. On the men's side, I think that it was an interesting time for our men's national team with the coaching change. Now Greg Berhalter's back, which I'm thrilled about. I think he's a great coach. I think, you know, for us to be hosting 2026 is going to be massive for our country. I'm so excited about it. And I think that they could be, you know, I think that they should have their sights on like quarterfinals. If they're not in the quarterfinals of a home World Cup in 2026, I think that that's, that's a letdown. That's a bummer. That's a failure with the growth of soccer in our nation and the talent. You know, obviously Pulisic, Weston McKennie. You have some really, really great players. Gio Reyna is doing some really good stuff. So the talent is there. I think the coaching staff is there, and our country is ready for it. So yeah, I think that's a great question. I think you're seeing a little bit of a leveling out. And on the women's side, unfortunately, it's the rest of the world catching up. And on the men's side, it's them catching up and kind of now being in the conversation of at least like the top 10. And if you're going to say quarterfinals, you got to say top 8, right? So I like to shoot for that. And yeah, looking forward to seeing how it unravels.
Do you welcome all the casual fans and the added attention that soccer gets in the U.S. during World Cup?
I do. I mean, anytime that I can, you know, get people on the bandwagon is great. I hope that people tune in, even it will be difficult time zones, but you know, I hope that people catch up on highlights and catch up and wake up early. I think it is must-see TV, you know? So yeah, I don't mind people jumping on the bandwagon for the big events. I think obviously the next step is to like, okay, then realize there is the NWSL, which is the professional league here in the States that has some really good soccer being played week in and week out, and get people into the MLS. You know, it's like, if you're just relying on the World Cup every 4 years, I mean, that's pretty hard to like have sustained fandom. So yeah, I think it's awesome. I think, you know, there hasn't been a World Cup in a long time that I have been here in America during it. So, you know, I was just obviously in Paris doing television. So I would ask my friends, like, is there good hype? And everybody would say like, yeah, people are talking about it. People are tuning in. And you certainly don't know that when you're a player, cause you really try to focus. Although like you are now with social media, like a lot of athletes are like, no, I don't look at that stuff, but like everyone's looking at it. Like you have to be like so crazy disciplined to not read some comments here and there. So yeah, I welcome the fans, and hopefully some people that don't think that they're soccer people will maybe tune into a game, and for, you know, a player or a play, they'll fall in love with the game and it'll stay with them. And this sport has meant a lot in my life. It's obviously the beautiful game across the world for a reason. And, you know, I think for Americans, for them to see maybe a 0-0 result or a 1-0 result, and somebody that can be like, that was the most exciting game I've ever seen, and it was like 0-0, like that to me is progress. And that makes me happy, and that makes me smile, because like I said, I love this game and I love this sport. And if I can get more people to feel as passionate as I am, yeah, I think that definitely 2026 will be an exciting tournament here in the U.S.
Yeah, no, it definitely gets a lot of attention here in the U.S. during the World Cup. And I mean, I feel like when the U.S. is playing, it overtakes social media. How do you feel about the U.S. national team's draw, and do you have a prediction you're willing to give for the 2023 Women's World Cup?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I'm willing to give my prediction. I always will think the U.S. is going to win. I said the other day, like, this is like me filling out the brackets of NCAA tournament, and I'm a huge Tar Heel. Like, I can essentially see campus out my window right now. Like, I'm a huge UNC person. And so as long as UNC is in the NCAA tournament, I'm going to write down UNC every time, even if it's like slightly crazy and delusional. This time for the U.S. team to win, it's not crazy and delusional. They have a very good chance of winning. Like I said, history has taught us to never doubt the U.S. team. But, you know, there are some other teams that I'm a little bit worried about. I think the hosts being Australia, they could like just have the entire nation behind them. Sam Kerr is probably one of the best goal scorers in the world right now, plays for Chelsea. She's 29. I think she's like kind of in her prime. Like, she's scoring. She's exciting. They have a coach that used to work with our team in 2015 and 2019. He was our assistant coach. His name's Tony Gustavsson. He's now their head coach. So this guy knows how to win. He knows his tactics, and he knows like pressure situations. So they have some good talent. They have him. They have the nation behind them. Of course, you know, some soccer powerhouses like France and England and I would say Germany, but they're kind of stumbling into the tournament right now, are also poised to do super well. But yeah, I am a little bit worried about Australia catching fire.
Heather, you were fantastic. Enjoy the 2023 Women's World Cup. Have a great call. And thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. That is Heather O'Reilly. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.